And now. In conversation with the boyhood heroes who became his broadcasting colleagues, this is My Radio 1. With Sean
Tilley. From its launch in 1967, right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years, as they each tell the story of their Radio 1. Sean
Tilley. My Radio 1.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this edition in which we remember what can only be described as a giant contribution made by an all-time great.
Simon Bates, the UK's favourite DJ.
Good morning, world.
So, Simon, we're talking 1972 when you joined the BBC after you returned from a long period of globetrotting. But it was Radio 2 that you appeared on initially.
Yeah, I came back after, 7 or 8 years in Australia and New Zealand and Southeast Asia. And the BBC in those days, to me anyway, was the complete impossible to get through the doors type place.
5 days a week, it's Album of the Week. Radio
2. And I went to see a guy called David Lloyd James, lovely man, who said, I'll give you a 3-month contract. Almost as soon as I walked through the door, he gave me a gin and tonic, which I thought was very nice. That wouldn't happen now, by the way.
Wherever you're listening, this Friday morning. Hands up on the box, say it's time to begin, and we're glad you're tuning our way. The music's all here and waiting to spin as we start to get ready to brighten your day. As you get out of bed, your radio smiles and says, good morning, it's a musical day. And that smile on your dial makes your cares and worries go away. So if you're heading for town or out in the country, let your radio entertain you. Radio 2 is company. In tune with you on Radio 2. In tune with you on Radio 2.
Yes, indeed, it's Radio 2. It says here, coming your way.
And I was working as a newsreader on Radio 2 and Radio 4. And then I was given a contract to work on Radio 1 and 2, depping for people. You know, if Blackburn was off or if Edmonds was off, I would fill in. I was the ghost in the machine, really.
18 and a half minutes after 2, you know the address of the Mystery Star. It's David Hamilton, Mystery Star, Radio 1, London W1A, 4WW. Okay, good afternoon. How are you feeling this afternoon? Yeah? Great. Just in the mood for Tina Charles.
It's 6 o'clock on Radios 1 and 2. My name's Simon Bates, standing in for Tom Brown, who's on holiday. And this is the Top 20, as compiled for the BBC by the British Market Research Bureau.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And one of the many programmes that you looked after on a regular basis was the Sunday evening chart show before you took it over full time.
The truth is, Sean, they were short of a gob. And I think that's certainly in your life and my life, that's always been the case. And yeah, I very unwillingly did the chart show because it's the most boring show you can do because you can't change the order of the records. And so you sit there thinking, God, I've got to list number 5 now and all that stuff. And the first 2 weeks I did it, Derek Chinnery was at that time the controller of Radio 1, and I checked the figures because all my life, figures are what you check, how many people listen. And the audience from Tom Brown, who'd been doing it before me and who then went to Hong Kong, the audience went down by 2/3. It went whop. So I looked at the figures and I thought, well, that's it. Career over. Went in to see Derek Chinnery and said, Derek, you know, I might as well hand my resignation in. And Chinnery was a very pragmatic man, very much a BBC man. And he said, what's the problem? I said, well, I've just lost you 2/3 of your audience. That's the problem. And he said, take a look at this. And on his desk, he had the television figures and he also had the radio figures. On television, the week I started, they put Robert Powell and Jesus of Nazareth
on. I remember it very well, yeah.
And every parent felt obligated to put their kids, you're not listening to the Top 40, not again, not while this is on. This is good for you. And that's why the audience went down. He said, wait 3 weeks, if it doesn't go up. And of course, I was making the complete idiot opinion of myself on this. I thought I mattered, and I was doing the damage.
Yeah.
With a Top 40 show, you just have to do it straight. Simon Bates.
Substitute
Altitude and Clouds, and before the number one, a full rundown of this week's top 20. At number 20, Life's Been Good for Joe Walsh. Number 19, Come Back and Finish What You Started for Gladys Knight and the Pips. And at number 18, Straight In, Darts and It's Raining. Number 17, On Their Way Down, Lindisfarne with Run for Home. At number 16, it's From East to West, Up for Voyage. Number 15, Like Clockwork, the Boomtown Rats. Number 14, A Little Bit of Soap for Shawaddy Waddy. And at number 13, Stay and Jackson Brown. Number 12 is 5705, City Boy. And number 11, Northern Lights for Renaissance. Into the 10, at number 10, Wild West Hero, On Its Way Down for Electric Light Orchestra. At number 9, If the Kids Are United, Sham 69. And number 8, Dancing in the City, Marshall Hay. Number 7, Forever Autumn, Justin Hayward. At number 6, Brown Girl in the Ring, Boney M. And at number 5, Three Times a Lady, Straight In and the Biggest Jump of the Week for the Commodores. Number 4 is The Smurf Song for Father Abraham. And at number 3, it's Boogie Oogie Oogie, A Taste of Honey. Number 2 is Substitute and Club. So for the ninth week.
It's funny, you know, isn't it? Because as a result of doing all this work, your profile was rising rapidly and you were becoming a very big Radio 1 name. But that was never your intention, really, was it?
It had never occurred to me to work for Radio 1, because the Radio 1 disc jockeys then were just so huge. You know, you couldn't walk down the street if you were with one of them. In fact, I do remember walking down Regent Street with Edmonds for a cup of coffee after a programme, and he was mobbed. It was impossible. So it never occurred to me that I'd be part of that. I think I was in the right place at the right time. They gave me, at Johnny Beerling's behest, the morning show. And I think that's pretty much where I always stayed.
Music while you work, and if you'd like to take part in Past, Present and Future, all you have to do is drop me a line, OK? Past, Present and Future, Simon Bates, Radio 1, London W1A4WW. On the card, would you put a few things about yourself, what you do, who your friends are, and of course, most important of all, your birthday, the month you were born in, and the year you were born in. And we will do our best to find out more about you than you know yourself.
The programme was pretty simple. I mean, it was a sequence programme based on the idea that we'd like you to listen another 5 minutes than you normally do. So we'd start off with the Golden Hour, guaranteed hits.
Simon Bates, the Golden Hour.
From a lady by the name of Lizzie Campbell, who said she loves the Golden Hour but finds the rest of it all a bit boring. So could I tell you in the Golden Hour who's on first to last, to see if it's worthwhile listening for the rest of the programme? Lizzie, it's the Rolling Stones at the moment, right about 11:20 every day. Thank you for the lesson. I guess 1 hour is better than none. 9:20.
It was Tony Blackburn that you took over the morning programme from. So he was the original host of the Golden Hour, but you decided to do it in a very different way.
I'm a great believer, and always have been, that radio progresses. You know, this week it's one thing, the next thing is a better thing. When I took over, I spoke to the executive producer about the Golden Hour, and she said, do it the way you want it done. It was actually created by Derek Chinnery, and I think it was a name rather than a thing. So Tony used to play every other record from the year. I developed it a bit into playing 2 half-hours solidly made up of records from different years, adding headlines. And I don't think it was any better. It just was different.
And on July the 1st, 1976, there was a heat wave on the south coast. It was so hot people couldn't drink. People were sweating and burning and melting in temperatures in the 90s. Southampton recorded a temperature on July the 1st, 1976, of 96 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the highest since records began.
After the Golden Hour, there was this hour that we didn't know what to do with, so we tended to put feature interviews in that. And those feature interviews we would try and make with really top people. And that's where good production comes in. I was lucky. I had the best producers, I think, in Radio 1 at that time. And therefore, the quality of stuff that was coming into me was much greater, possibly, than for one or two other people.
Why are you still recording? It's a question that everybody wants me to ask you, because you don't need to. You are a success. You are a star. So why the amount of energy that you put into it?
I actually enjoy it, you know. If I didn't have to do it, I think I'd try and do it as a hobby, just because I really do like doing it. It actually seems strange to me why anyone would think I wouldn't like doing it.
Yeah, but you also involve yourself with all the peripheral activities, like people like me coming down, doing television programmes, doing what they call promotion, which is hard work, gets away from the real business, which is music, and yet you're prepared to do it.
Well, I could have you chucked out.
The reason that we did long-form interviews, as they call it in the trade, you'd hear about 10 minutes of it every day between Monday and Friday, was to give a more complete picture of the person. It wasn't to ruin them, to destroy them or anything like that, because they were always affectionate and soft, if you like, interviews. The real reason was so that if you listened across the week, and we wanted you to listen across the week, then you'd get a bigger picture, a more accurate picture of, say, Keith Richards, who pulled a gun on me in Times Square while we were doing an interview there. And I'm not going to tell you the rest.
I don't think, Simon, that I'd be that wide of the mark if I said that during the 16 years, as it turned out, that you hosted the morning show on Radio 1, the one feature that's remembered more than any other is our tune. How was the idea conceived?
It was invented by a guy called Ron Belchier, who briefly was my producer when I first started on daytime at Radio 1. And the idea was, you wrote in for a request. Hello, I'd really like to have the Nolans for the guy with the shirt that I met who left. We thought that's what it would be, but it wasn't. It was taken over by the audience, which is always the best thing. If you ever hear a disc jockey trawling for answers to things, it's wrong. Because what happens is when a feature like our tune really works, and I think it did, it's owned by the listener.
The song on today's Our Tune is by Janice Ian. It's actually sung by Roberta Flack. There is a twist in the tale of this one. It comes from Hampshire, and the things that really happened in the last 5 years to two people, one person in particular, would make, I guess, most people give up all hope. If you want to talk about courage, then have a listen to this letter.
And it's you can talk all those cliches about the Navy stopping for a cup of tea and a weep and lorry drivers pulling over on the M54. All that you can mention. But I think it got to the heart of something. And personally, I think the reason was that it was their story. We never souped it up. We never tried to make it sound more exciting, more depressing, more thrilling than it was. It was straight from the pages. And that's what you couldn't do. You couldn't make those stories up.
The epilogue is that they're now living in their own home in Gosport. It's a small house. They're worried about the mortgage payments like everybody is. But it's theirs. The kids are healthy. The kids are healthy and loud. And Lynn is doing well, so is Chris. The things that have happened over the years, people may scoff at. But when you think of what she's gone through, you realise how tough this lady is. 5'2", not big, with a slight frame and a shy smile. And yet she seems to take on almost any problems and to cope with them. You may care to know who wrote the letter. It was her husband, Chris.
Jesse.
So we get to December 1979. Well, it had to happen, really, especially when you consider that you've been given a daily Radio 1 show in 1977. Eventually, the call comes from BBC Television Centre, and it's from Top of the Pops, asking you to host the programme for the very first time. What are your memories of that?
Gordon Elsbury, who was a deputy producer on Top of the Pops, rang me when I was working at Radio 1 and said, would you like to do Top of the Pops this week? And I said to him, have you seen what I look like? And he roared with laughter. And he said the most telling thing. He said, Top of the Pops is not about the presenter.
Right.
And boy, was he right.
Right, here's a bunch of old songs with a new cut to them. Kicking off with Duds and Little Richards. Reet Petit.
Why is it, do you think, it went 2 years before you were actually invited onto the programme?
Well, because you're looking at me now. No, because there was a... genuinely, when you come to that sort of thing, the Tony Blackburns, the Mike Reeds, all of whom I respect hugely for what they do, were the essence of Top of the Pops when the presenter was the local soapbox king. And that wasn't me.
When you did eventually end up doing the show, you became one of the most regular presenters for the best part of 10 years. Did that surprise you in that case?
You never thought like that because it wasn't a regular gig. As far as I know, I've never actually talked to anybody about this. They used to ring you on the Thursday and say, Top of the Pops next week, would you like to do it? Commercially, of course, it was £75. Complete waste of time. But if you, the feeling was that if you didn't do it, however uncomfortable you felt, the bosses at Radio 1 might blink a bit and say, well, he's obviously being difficult, and is this the direction he's going in which case, why doesn't he do 12 till 2 in the morning? The ritual, for me anyway, and I don't know about anybody else, was rush off to Monmouth Street and find something to wear that made you look faintly human, and get your hair done. That was the other thing. You turned up, I think, 2:30 in the afternoon with the aforesaid haircut and the clothes that made you look faintly human, but now, of course, look utterly ridiculous. And you did your job. You had a dressing room, so you were, I suppose, a cog in the machine.
That's Michael Jackson and Legs and Company. It gets hot in here, but even hotter now. Here's Sugar Hill Gang and one of the fastest climbers of the week. It's the Rapper.
A couple of recollections about your days on the Radio 1 Roadshow would be nice. We'll get around to that story regarding Scotland and Steve Wright, which I know you're itching to tell. But the other roadshow memory you have is not a traditional one. You know, we're not talking seaside resorts here at all, are we?
Someone on the serious side of the BBC said, let's do a Europe week. And we ended up in Berlin with the roadshow just by the Brandenburg Gate and a bloke shooting at me. And I remember Claire saying, someone's shooting at you, love. And I said, no. The idea of someone shooting at me, what a ridiculous idea. And then one of these little pellet things hit me, and I did what any good broadcaster would do. I screamed, get off the stage, and we all ran for our lives. But probably, I don't know, a most affectionate memory would be Steve and I. Steve Wright and I, against his better judgment, did a series of outside broadcasts, and we were recording the previous night in Scotland. And I said, well, of course, you know what this area is famous for. And he said, yes. And I said, what? And he said, squirrels. What? And he then said something very specific about squirrels. And I was laughing, I think, for an hour and a half. We couldn't do the programme. Steve had a mighty twinkle on his face and went to bed early without a drink.
The Radio 1 Roadshow.
And then you came to that inevitable time, I guess, when it wasn't just you, but it was your production team at Radio 1 that decided that perhaps it wasn't a good idea to go out and do the roadshow anymore. But it wasn't quite that simple, was it?
I said to Beerling, to Johnny Beerling, the boss, you can't go on with this. He said, why not? And I said, well, look at Mike Reed's legs and then look at mine.
They are lovely legs, actually, oh, Mike. It has to be said. Yeah.
And Mike, you know, there's a certain kind of person who can do that. And I do think you have to feel comfortable with it. And I got to the stage where I just thought, that's a year too far. So we were in the pub. Mad Johnny Ruffle, me, and Fergus Dudley. And in March of that year, and all of us said, drinking, they said, you can't go on with the roadshow, you're making a fool of yourself. And I thought, they're right. So I said, okay, fine, what do we do? Because I can't go to my management and say, I don't want to do the roadshow, unless I can offer something else. And that's the great thing in this business, you know that. Never, never have one kettle boiling, you've got to have two or three. So Fergus, I think, who is still at the BBC and doing brilliantly well, got out a Let's Schoolboy Diary, and he said, go around the world. So Johnny and I, or John rather, and I, put a package together, which we had no idea if we could do, went to the controller and said, look, his legs are awful. You don't want to put him on the roadshow. And Johnny saw, who's a pragmatic guy, said, yeah, I can see what you mean. Why don't we do this instead? And that's how I got out of it.
And you did all these wonderful programs around the world.
Well, I haven't heard them.
Yeah.
But who knows?
International Radio 1.
We have 30 seconds to go before the round the world
this
trip.
This is where we go, kids.
67 days. Best of luck to you both.
Can I please hear a round of applause for Simon Bates and Jonathan Ruffle as they leave for the round the world trip? They get a gigantic round of applause. Right now, Bates and Ruffle are off to Barry Island, Wales, to board a ship off to Antigua and around the world. It's noon. Great Britain, and Bates and Ruffell are away.
And I took a flight to Cannes to some festival or other the following week and was looking at the in-flight directory, and there were the magic words, Inmarsat. Now, this is way before emails, way before the internet. All right. So you didn't have an iPhone. It was even before the time when you had those mobile phones that were like bricks. So we started building it from square one and looking at it, and we discovered it was possible to do outside broadcasts by satellite from anywhere. But the problem was you had to take with you two suitcases, 40 kilograms each. And because we were young and stupid, we thought, that's okay. And then we thought, well, we can't play records from around the world, so we need a basic studio in Broadcasting House, as it was. And Fergus Dudley agreed, stupidly, because we promised him that it would only be half an hour's extra work a day. And he said, oh, fair enough. He was young. And that's not a mistake he'll make again. And off we went, literally, with these two suitcases. And wherever we were, on the sea or on land, we had to erect all sorts of gubbins to get these things to work. Jonathan, who is a brilliant producer, but I have to tell you, not a great technician, went through a course of fear with Inmarsat to make sure that the system worked. And what we did was, some of the programs were directly live. Some of the programs were live as, that is, they were sent half an hour before. And if we knew we were going through a bad area in Central America or somewhere like that, Nicaragua particularly was a worry, then we would record what you call 2.5 minutes pieces and send them back, and Fergus and Brian Thompson would assemble them in Broadcasting House. I have to say, it's something that I'm incredibly proud of, and I think it proves more than anything, great production is the most important thing you can have on radio. You can have great voices, you can have great scripts, you can have great turns, great performers, but in the end, if you don't have great committed production, you ain't got a radio station.
Good morning, Great Britain. We are coming to you live by satellite from a place about 40 kilometers outside Bangalore in India. It's just gone 2 o'clock here, and it is the most perfectly British setting you could possibly imagine. In fact, the countryside is very British in many ways. The game of cricket that's going on my right-hand side, well done, is a special one. And I'll give you a clue. 1 in 5 of the world's blind live in India.
Before we go any further on around the world, it's important to remember that we didn't just do it as a jolly. We were raising funds for Oxfam at the time. And that meant that their contacts led us to meeting people. For example, I remember a hypnotic day, very still day in Bangalore, and we were taken to a school. And you think, okay, it's a school. And it was a school for the blind, and normally, any broadcaster will tell you this, you deal with that as sensitively as you can, but there's always a school for the blind. This one, on this particular day, was playing its championship cricket match, and these were blind kids. And they had a cricket ball with a bell inside, and they were playing it by listening to where the ball was. Actually, listening to that stuff from Bangalore reminds me of a water well. It was another Oxfam project. I'm not plugging Oxfam for the sake of it. But bear in mind that we are negotiating Central America in a war patch with these two huge pieces of equipment. And we were relying an awful lot on local people. And the local people didn't know who the hell I was. They certainly didn't know who Jonathan Ruffell was. And they didn't care very much. But wherever we went, particularly in, I would say, third world countries, they were helpful and they were supportive. On one occasion, we had an old pickup truck in Mexico. We drove into a town when there was a wedding on. And there were three of us, and the wedding looked a bit surprised as we rolled up, and then half an hour later we were having paella as honoured guests of the wedding party. There was the water well in Nicaragua, I guess, was one of those humbling experiences, because you see those endless ads about people having to walk, 10 kilometres for their water in third world countries. And this was the first time I'd actually seen it happening. And the day we arrived, they'd completed the water well, which was going to change their lives, change the whole village. And there's something, it's like an art tune, I suppose. There's something that is genuine about these things that you can't recreate, not even for radio, but you certainly can't recreate for television. And that is that moment of awe and wonder when families gather around and are only 100 yards from their house and can fill their buckets with fresh water.
Right now, I ought to tell you what you won't be getting from this programme. You won't be hearing experts speculating on the progress of the war. You won't be hearing the press briefings given by the military or by the politicians. What you will be hearing is the voices of the people on the ground here in the desert.
There were rumblings, if you remember, about the first Gulf War, and we went out really, you know, extraordinary, just got on a plane, I suppose, went to Al Jubail in the UAE and landed and got ourselves the gear that we were being lent by BFBS, brilliant organisation, and we did a February the 14th special with the troops there. All it was, very, very simple, was a Valentine's Day messages from the troops to loved ones at home and vice versa. And we wandered about a bit because we had good radio coverage in the desert and then at the side of one of the ships that was serving there. And, well, you know, I'm going to say it now. It was very moving. It was because it was genuine and because it was live. If we'd gone out and recorded stuff and then come back, it would have been a load of old tosh and it would have sounded very slick, but it wouldn't have had heart.
Jackie Clark.
Where are you from, Jackie?
Durham, northeast of England.
And I know where it is.
Well, not many people do, that's why I said it.
What are the family's names?
My parents, you want to know their name? Yeah. Olive and Alan. And I've got a brother, David, and a sister-in-law, Lynn.
Boyfriend, husband?
A boyfriend, actually, Twofield Hospital.
Message to the folks back home.
Lots of love to Mum and Dad. Miss you lots. Hope to see you soon. Love to David and Lynn and to the dogs as well, Bonnie and Brooke.
I'm sure you'll regard this as almost an impossible question to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. When you think back at such a long period at Radio 1, is there one abiding memory for you? What comes into your mind first? It could be an incident, it could be a project that you worked on, it could be a colleague, anything.
I'm not a great one for looking back, because if you do look back too much, then you remember the disasters and the things that went wrong. But if I was to look back on those years at Radio 1, they're dominated, I think, by Alan Freeman's face, because Fluff was doing a once-a-week show, and he used to come when he was very tired, because he was getting on in those yet days, he used to come into my studio and sit down and mouth obscenities at me while I was live on air. And I look back on him as being just one of the loveliest people I ever met.
The Nolan Sisters at number 3 with I'm in the Mood for Dancing. At number 2, Coward of the County by Kenny Rogers. And at number 1, Top of the Tree in 1980, The Specials. Too Much, Too Young.
What about your proudest achievement at Radio 1? If there's one highlight that completely stands out above any other for you.
The highlight for me was Prince. We had a phone call a couple of days before saying Prince would like to do a gig at the Radio Theatre in London, in the BBC, at 10 o'clock, it was, 10 o'clock, on Tuesday morning. And Fergus and I talked about this, and the one thing, in retrospect, that we didn't do was ask for a contract. Now, you know, how crazy is that? How irresponsible of me and of him. And we never got another phone call. They'd said they'd turn up at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning. And I remember sitting on the fourth floor of Broadcasting House, looking into the street where the access to the Radio Theatre is, with Fergus. And Fergus very quietly saying to me, you know, if we didn't get that phone call, if we dreamt that phone call, if he doesn't bother to get out of bed this morning, we're stuffed. And at that moment, round the corner, came the first of the two Pantechnicons. And that was, I think, the most exciting thing. Again, it's great production. It's great people from engineering who got the whole thing together. I remember Fergus even moving Radio 4 News and a drama that was being recorded, because the sound obviously would waft in their direction. And to see Prince just do this stuff on the hoof, and for our guys to do it on the hoof, makes you so proud of the BBC.
Simon Bates, thank you very much for sharing your Radio 1 with me.
Would you do me a favour before we get back to Radio 1, would you show your appreciation the standard way by just giving a hell of a lot of noise?